Welcome to WISO Weekend, your weekly radio magazine. I'm Jerry Kenny. Thanks for joining us this Sunday morning. Coming up on today's program, we've got an update on what's taking place at the Montgomery County Jail after 10 civil lawsuits were filed alleging misconduct by police officers. We'll hear about resignations at the Ohio State House after misconduct allegations surfaced there. And later in the program, commentaries from Bob Brekka and our very own Bill Felker. Up first, Clark County has seen a record number of overdose deaths this year, but widespread use of Narcan is also allowing many people who overdose to survive and use again, raising their risk of dying the next time. To help curb overdose deaths, advocates, first responders, and addiction specialists are collaborating on a new approach. It's aimed at quickly connecting high-risk addicts to treatment. Clark County Community Voices producer Renee Wild has more.
The typical approach for an overdose is for the first responders to administer Narcan until the victim has revived. At Springfield Fire Department headquarters, Fire Chief Nick Heimlich says sometimes it takes as many as 8 doses of the overdose blocker to resuscitate a single victim. And when they wake up, many victims resist further treatment.
They're anxious. They want to get away. They don't want to talk to anybody. And what we have effectively done is move the clock all the way forward to their next need for the drug, because their body now is going through withdrawal, and they'll tell you that withdrawal means I'm sick, and the only way I don't feel sick is if I use.
Heimlich says many Springfield medical crews are growing frustrated by how fast the overdose victims begin using again.
They're checking out of the hospital emergency department against medical advice before we're even restocked and back in our ambulances on the street. There's nothing to catch them.
So to fix this problem, Clark County first responders are testing a new approach. It's called the Warm Handoff Program, and here's how it works. In an overdose situation, EMTs and paramedics administer less Narcan. This method is designed to slow down the time it takes for the victim to wake up, and that gives hospital staff more time to contact a mental health counselor. Officials say the hope is to link addicts who survive an overdose with recovery services before they even leave the hospital.
And then this therapist and this peer support specialist go in and say, hey, we care about you. We're worried. We know you just overdosed, and this is a plan.
Wendy Doolittle is the CEO of the nonprofit Springfield Addiction Treatment Agency, McKinley Hall. She says $26 billion in federal opioid epidemic funding is helping to pay for 2 additional on-call counselors for the program. Doolittle says overdose victims who agree to enter the drug treatment program are able to start right away.
And then when you're released, we're going to take you to our safe house that's staffed 24/7, and we're going to find you a residential bed, and we're going to keep you on medication that will help you to stabilize and to enter into recovery.
Back at the firehouse in downtown Springfield, Chief Heimlich says that he hopes this new warm handoff approach will help the city address some of the root causes of the overdose death rate.
The solution isn't to go to the citizens and ask for more paramedics and more Narcan to treat more addicts. That's not the solution. That's just managing the process. The solution is to slow and then cut off the pipeline.
The warm handoff program officially started September 1st, but officials say it's too soon to know for sure whether the program will have a lasting impact on Clark County's overdose epidemic. For WYSO, I'm Renee Wild.
And in other news coming out of Springfield, the police department there has been understaffed for months. But thanks to a temporary tax hike approved by voters earlier this year, the department is again accepting applications. Community Voices producer Jason Reynolds reports the new officers will go a long way toward responding to the city's drug overdose crisis.
Springfield voters approved the temporary tax increase in May. Some of the nearly 0.5% bump will pay for 6 new police officers to launch a so-called Safe Streets Task Force to combat violent crime and drug activity. At Springfield Police Headquarters, Captain Lee Graff says the added officers will take some pressure off of the police department. Opioid overdose calls into the city's 911 switchboard are up dramatically.
I file all the reports every month. I've had to double the room in my file cabinet because of these overdoses. So I'm talking an inch and a half stack, of which almost an inch of it is opioid addiction.
Responding to high numbers of overdose calls can be tough on officers. Meredith Freeman is Springfield's opioid diversion officer. She says the hardest part of responding to a drug call is when a child is involved.
any call that I've been on here lately with overdoses, and the person that calls is the child, and knowing that our dispatchers are trying to talk a small child through, what was your mom or your daddy breathing, you know, whatever the situation might be. And the first thing you do when you go in the house is you want to render aid to the person who's possibly overdosed. But then you look over and you see this kid just standing there as we're all running around.
Freeman says she knows her work is making a difference. Still, it's hard to see her hometown struggle with drugs and drug-related crime.
Every day you come out and you fight and you fight, and sometimes you cannot make a difference. But then it kind of turns around to that being the best thing, because that few times you do make a difference in this city, it just takes you back to we're one step closer to getting this city to where it was when I grew up.
Those type of improvements will take more police officers. But even with the additional tax revenue and help from the Attorney General's office, the department won't have enough officers anytime soon. The Springfield City Charter requires the department to have 124 officers. The department has just 113 right now. And Graff says he expects the department to lose three more officers by January.
I liken running a police department, looking at personnel, is kind of running from the well with a leaking bucket, because you're continually losing people to retirement, and now we're seeing some cross-hiring and all that, and you're continually filling the bucket, but you're always losing a little bit.
Recruiting and training new officers is expensive, and they don't start overnight. It's a long process. Officers must complete a civil service test, polygraph, psych exam, extensive background check, interview, and a physical. Then, once hired, the cadets are paid, but they're still not quite ready. They need over 700 hours of police academy training, 6 to 8 weeks of in-service, and 13 weeks of field training.
Then finally, after all that time, they're released on the street to work on their own. But that process can take, you know, up to a year. And then, of course, with all the training, it's a substantial investment.
And attracting officers is already a challenge. One reason is pay. In Springfield, officer pay starts at just under $43,000 a year. Wealthier cities pay a lot more. Centerville starts at just over $57,000. Kettering starts at over $60,000. With the number of overdoses in Springfield continuing to climb, Graff says it's critical that the department find a way to attract more officers. He's not waiting for potential police cadets to come in. Graff has spent the fall visiting Miami Valley colleges and police academies and reaching out to the NAACP. And Officer Freeman says she's hoping the potential recruits will see the police work as about more than just money.
If you're in this job for strictly the money, this probably isn't the place for you. But if you are in this job because you want to do real police work and get into a lot of diverse calls, drugs, domestic violence, traffic, it's a great department for that. There's a lot of opportunity here.
Freeman says being a Springfield police officer isn't for everyone, but the department is accepting applications until 5 p.m. on Friday, November 17th. For WYSO, I'm Jason Reynolds.
I'm Jerry Kenny. You're listening to WYSO Weekend on 91.3 WYSO. Thanks so much for joining us. A recent report in the Dayton Daily News reveals that Montgomery County has paid out more than $1 million settling civil lawsuits alleging misconduct by officers. Dayton Daily News investigative reporter Josh Swigert has been following the story and fills us in on the latest developments, which includes a not guilty plea entered by one of the officers, Captain Judith Seeley, who has been charged with assault of a prisoner.
Captain Seeley pleaded not guilty this week to the misdemeanor assault charges. The investigation started with the Montgomery County Prosecutor's Office. They reviewed it, went to grand jury, which determined there was not sufficient evidence for felony charges. But Matt Heck, the county prosecutor, said that didn't rule out misdemeanor charges. City of Dayton prosecutors took up the case, looked at it, and decided, you know, we're going to have the city of Cincinnati review these charges just to make sure there's no appearance of a conflict of interest. The chief prosecutor for the city of Dayton is on a jail advisory panel that was created in response to this and other lawsuits and this issue. So she didn't want there to be any appearance of conflict. So she had the city of Cincinnati prosecutors review the information in the case, look at the video, and the charges were filed last week, and she entered a not guilty plea this week.
The charges pepper spraying Amber Swink while she was strapped into a restraint chair. There's actually video of that.
Correct.
Her attorney does not believe she should have been charged criminally. What would the alternative have been?
If it goes to trial, then he'll make that argument. He told us, quote, "I recognize what the video depicts, but that doesn't tell the entire story." And so I think he's holding on to the entire story. And if it does go in front of a judge, then I'm sure he'll elaborate on what the context is that he thinks is necessary.
And Swink, of course, had issued a lawsuit against Montgomery County, but she has since settled that lawsuit back in August, correct?
Yeah, Amber Swink settled that lawsuit for $375,000. There have been a few others that followed in rapid succession. There's a total of 10 lawsuits that we've been tracking against Montgomery County, as well as others against other area counties and area jails, Clark County, Warren County. Not nearly as many as Butler County is facing at the moment. So Amber Swink settled in August for $375,000. In October, there was another settlement for $75,000. A woman named Marsha Pate Strickland, a guy named Daryl Wallace, then settled for $58,000. And the largest one, actually, was Emily Evans, who settled her lawsuit for $380,000. Those settlements and the related legal fees have brought the price tag to the county for these lawsuits to over $1 million, as we reported a couple days ago.
What's next in all of this? Do we wait for more to come out of the advisory panel, or what's next?
There's a lot going on here. The Judith Seeley case has to possibly go to a judge. She pleaded not guilty, so the trial work in that begins in December. Separately from that, and stemming out of that, is an FBI probe that's still ongoing. An issue that's being looked at there, we're told, is that there was video of this incident that had disappeared from the county records and only reappeared in the Amber Swink lawsuit. So there's a big, big question there about the disappearance of public records and evidence of this issue. So those issues are still moving ahead. At the same time, there's questions about overcrowding at the jail. We had another story that ran over the weekend about jails across Ohio. I mean, Montgomery County is not alone in this, that two-thirds of Ohio's county jails are either overcrowded or not meeting state safety and security standards, our analysis found. Montgomery County is at 179% of capacity. The Jail Advisory Committee members tell me that that's a big issue for them. They're trying to figure out, do we need a bigger jail, or do we need to have more programs to lessen the number of people at the jail and have more diversion programs, mental health programs, and drug screening programs? Some of these issues have been health or opioid-related withdrawal problems. So this isn't a simple issue with a simple fix. This is going to be something we'll be talking about for some time, covering for some time, and there's a lot of aspects to this that need to be looked at closely, because there's a lot of taxpayer money on the line and the safety and well-being of inmates and corrections officers at the jail.
Josh Schweigert, investigative reporter with the Dayton Daily News. Thanks for your time and the information today.
Thank you.
Two Republican state lawmakers and a Democratic Senate staffer have resigned in the last month, all over what's been termed inappropriate behavior. This raises the question of whether there is a culture at the State House that somehow attracts or encourages behavior that makes people feel uncomfortable or afraid. Ohio Public Radio's Joe Ingles filed this report.
Back in the 80s, Marianne Sharkey left a job as a reporter at the Dayton Journal-Herald to become a statehouse reporter. She says she quickly discovered there was a good old boy culture throughout the Capitol and was shocked at what she discovered.
When I first came there, the press room was was more like a locker room. There were nude photos hanging on the walls above reporters' cubicles. There was a box full of, sort of Playboys and penthouses, and the whole place was a bit of a culture shock for me.
Sharkey was one of only a handful of female reporters who were blazing their way through what had been a man's world. She knew the male reporters hung out at bars across the street from the State House, where she didn't feel welcome. She says a hint of sex was everywhere.
Oh, it was extremely blatant. It was very blatant. I mean, you would see... you know, I used to always joke about where's the runway for the aides, because they would have all these young, beautiful aides working for these legislators who would go over there at the, you know, and meet them at the bar at night. And, you know, some of them were known to take, you know, to use the hotel rooms at the Neal House.
It's important to note that not all male legislators or reporters engaged in bad behavior. Sharkey says she saw the culture beginning to change in the 90s, around the time she went from being a reporter to working for Republican Governor Bob Taft. Charlita Tavares was working at the State House back in those days, too. First as a legislative aide. In 1994, she was elected as a Democratic state representative from Columbus and became the first ever African-American woman to hold a leadership role in the legislature. She's now a state senator. Tavares says the State House is still a male-dominated culture. Last week, she wrote an open letter saying what current leaders have done is not enough to change attitudes and behavior.
It spoke to coming together as women to ensure that we have a culture of safety here within the General Assembly, that we are going to protect the women within our organization, and that we're going to make sure that anybody comes who comes into the facilities, that they are safe as well.
Tavares says her effort is not partisan, and she invited Republican women in the legislature to sign on to it.
We opened it to all women. We had some Republican staff initially that added their name and then later took their name off.
Tavares says she's not sure why they removed their names, and at this point, none of the 30 women who have signed on to it are Republicans. It's not just the culture, but the way it's often spun when problems are identified. Both Tavares and Sharkey say they don't like the way the term inappropriate behavior is now being used as a catch-all phrase. It's being used to describe behavior ranging from the sexual harassment and predatory behavior former Republican Senator Cliff Hite has been accused of and apologized for, to the off-color comment Republican Representative Mike Henney admitted he made, to whatever it was that led to the resignation of Senate Democratic Caucus Chief of Staff Mike Primo. And it was used to describe the conduct of former Republican Representative Wes Goodman in his office, which led to Goodman's resignation. Sharkey says it's important for the public to know if the behavior being sanctioned crossed the line from insulting to intimidating or worse.
Clearly the line is drawn when there are when someone either physically attacks somebody or sexually harasses someone to the point where they feel like they have to leave their job or they feel like their job is threatened. There's a big difference between, say, making an inappropriate joke, an inappropriate comment, and actually acting on it.
Tavares says she thinks leaders handling these situations need to provide information to protect the public, but she says they also need to make sure not to reveal too much.
You don't want so much detail given out so you can pinpoint who that individual was.
That's something she says happened in at least one of these recent cases. Women in the State House are outnumbered in the legislature and the press corps that covers lawmakers. But there's one place where women outnumber men. There are more female legislative aides and staffers. Joe Ingles at the Ohio Public Radio State House News Bureau.
You're listening to WISO Weekend on 91.3 WYSO. I'm Jerry Kenney. Thanks for joining us. Lancaster High School, southeast of Columbus, is changing the way it handles detention. Instead of forcing kids to sit in a boring classroom after school, they're turning to the Youth Yoga Project. WOSU's Adora Namigade reports on the effort to teach misbehaving students new coping skills.
On a Tuesday afternoon, Lauren Greenspan leads three students to an inconspicuous building right next to the main school.
They can kind of slip over here without being noticed too much. And it's a room with no windows, so you don't have to be like downward dog wondering if people are staring at you.
That could be awkward.
Yeah.
With the students' help, she transforms what looks like a typical classroom used for detention into a yoga studio.
You guys can start moving the desks just forward towards the front wall and back towards the back wall so that we can make a space in the middle.
Greenspan lays out yoga mats, soft yoga blocks, blankets, and lavender-infused eye pillows. The class begins.
What do you know about what this program is about and what we're going to be doing?
It's to relieve stress.
Okay, to relieve stress. What else?
These makeshift yoga studios have been a welcome respite for students like Derek Mitchell. He got in trouble for ditching class.
I skipped school. I think it was 3 times.
Before this school year, the normal punishment would have been Wednesday night school, a 2-hour detention. But administrators gave him the yoga option.
And then they said I could do yoga instead. So obviously an hour of yoga is going to be 2 hours of sitting in a classroom doing nothing.
This program is possible because of the Youth Yoga Project. That's a nonprofit founded by Columbus teacher and yoga instructor Lauren Greenspan. This is the first year she's running the detention alternative in Lancaster. It's called REACT, which stands for Restorative Exercises and Coping Techniques.
So when we're angry, we're taking short, shallow breaths in our chest. Like that's communication to our body that we need to get ready to fight, flight, or freeze. We're like preparing with adrenaline, to get ready to take action.
Greenspan teaches the students calming exercises they can use when they're in class.
Our aim is to equip them with healthy tools that they can use anytime, any place through their breathing, focused awareness on their body and relaxation techniques so that they can calm their nervous system and their brain and make more responsible decisions.
Lancaster High School teacher Laura Specht helped bring the program to her school after seeing a similar one in her Facebook feed.
One thing that I think happens with normal detention is our students go into a room, they have to sit there for an hour, they're supposed to bring something to do, they usually don't, they stare straight ahead or try and sleep for the hour and then they leave. They never have to think about why they're there.
It's for students who commit minor offenses like defiance and noncompliance. Senior Derek Mitchell only joined to get out of detention, but now he kind of likes it.
Honestly, it kind of clears your mind a little bit because that's all you think about. You don't have to think about anything else.
He says even after his punishment is up, he'll still come back. The Tuesday classes are only for kids avoiding detention, but any student can go to sessions on Thursdays. Teacher Laura Specht says it's hard to measure the program's success because it only started 6 weeks ago, but she hopes to see long-term benefits.
I think our goal is if they can better manage the stresses in their life, perhaps they won't continue to encounter the discipline problems that they're facing at school.
For Ohio Public Radio, I'm Adora Namigadde.
Since this year's hurricanes in the Gulf region and the Caribbean, University of Dayton professor Bob Bracca has turned his attention to how the Miami Valley might cope with severe flooding and takes a look at research done by one of his University of Dayton colleagues for clues.
Extreme weather events were in the news quite a bit this summer, from brutal heat waves in southern Europe to forest fires in the northwestern U.S., and maybe most noticeably, the incredible rainfalls brought about by Hurricane Harvey in Houston and the Gulf Coast region. Harvey was a fairly powerful hurricane that was noticeable because it hovered over Houston for such a long period of time and even circled around for a second hit. Some were calling Harvey's flooding a 500-year event or even a 1,000-year event. We have to be careful about the language here. A 1,000-year event is one that only has a 0.1% chance of happening in any given year. It doesn't mean that this was the first time in 1,000 years such flooding occurred. We can't know that for a young city like Houston. The strange thing is that Houston has now had so-called 500-year floods for each of the past 3 years. That begins to sound like estimates for Houston are off somehow. But what about the Miami Valley? How are we prepared for extreme rainfalls? Those familiar with Dayton history will know that the Great Flood of 1913 was a defining event for the city. However, it was not by any means the first time Dayton flooded. Severe floods happened about every 20 years or so prior to 1913. Political and civic leaders decided to find someone to apply the best science and engineering knowledge possible to prevent future disasters in the city. Arthur Morgan spent a lot of time analyzing how often big floods occur, including a trip to Europe where weather records were much longer. The result was the establishment of the Miami Conservancy District and the series of 5 dry dams on rivers in the watershed of the Great Miami River. The dams are designed to protect against floods up to 40% larger than the one in 1913. It's fairly likely that careful engineering design by Morgan means that the full capacity of the retarding areas behind the dams will never be fully used. One reason that rare floods seem to be coming more often in a place like Houston is that any reliance on historical data means that we are assuming that all of the background conditions remain the same. But we know that climate change is altering ocean and air temperatures and therefore increasing the amount of water held in the atmosphere. If we don't take those changes into account, we can't expect to get the frequency of extreme events right. My colleague Shuang-Yi Wu and other scientists have looked at the expected changes in extreme precipitation events under climate change and find that the strongest storms will increase the most. Shuang-Yi has also looked specifically at the Miami Valley and impacts from extreme precipitation. She's found that there will likely be more extreme events, such as some of those we experienced this past summer and in other recent years. But the century-old flood control system designed by Arthur Morgan should handle even these changes relatively easily. Of course, as she's also pointed out, if we were ever to receive 40 inches of rain all at once, all bets are off. The rainfall leading to the 1913 flood was about 10 inches, falling on frozen ground. There are other man-made factors that play into the vulnerability of cities, such as the lack of or poor enforcement of zoning regulations, the removal of mangroves and wetlands and other natural buffering mechanisms, and increases in hard surfaces that cause runoff to be more rapid. We're lucky here in the Miami Valley that over a century ago, leaders had enough foresight to plan well for the future and to respect the power of nature while doing so. For WYSO, this is Bob Brekka.
Bob Brekka is a professor of physics and renewable and clean energy at the University of Dayton. He is research director of UD's Hanley Sustainability Institute and tweets at Bob Brekka. For more stories and commentaries, visit our website, wyso.org.
This is Bill Felker with Poor Will's Almanac for the second week of late fall and the final quarter of the apple cider moon. November is getting pretty far along now, and most of the leaves have come down throughout the northern half of the United States. The likelihood of frost and snow flurries become stronger. The Pleiades are well up in the east in the late evening, followed by Aldebaran and Taurus, and Orion and Winter are not far behind them. The apple cider moon seeds to the paperwhite moon on November 18th, so this is a perfect week to place paperwhite bulbs in water so they bloom for midwinter, or purchase a grow light and flats and soil for starting seeds of flowers like geraniums or coleus that will flower in the spring. Some nurseries have seeds out already, or you can order and maybe have your seeds to put in at December's new bedding plant moon just a month from now on December 18th. With your seeds tucked in under a warm grow light, you can go outside under the dark moon to watch the Leonid meteors after midnight on the 17th and 18th. And if you happen to see one of those shooting stars, legends suggest that good luck will follow you in the year ahead. It may be less trouble, though, to watch the sun, which is now within only a couple of degrees from its lowest position in the sky. Paying attention at a south window, note how far the sun advances between today and mid-December solstice. From this private observatory, you can watch and actually measure the sun's approach to solstice and then its retreat towards spring. This is Bill Felker with Poor Will's Almanac. I'll be back again next week with notes for the third week of late fall. In the meantime, get some seeds, watch the moon, keep track of the sun. Poor Will's Almanac for 2018 is now available. Order yours from Amazon, or for an autographed copy, order from poorwillsalmanac.com. That's almanac with a K.
Bill Felker contributes to newspapers nationwide, including the Yellow Springs News. Bill resides in Yellow Springs. Poor Will's Almanac is also available as a podcast at wyso.org.
That's it for this edition of WISO Weekend on 91.3 WYSO, giving voice to our community, our nation, and our world. I'm Jerry Kenny. We'll be back next Sunday morning at 10. Thanks so much for joining us. Up next on WISO, it's Vic McCunis with The Book Nook.